This is Psalm 120. I call on the Lord in my distress, and he answers me. Save me, Lord, from lying lips and from deceitful tongues. What will he do to you, and what more decides, you deceitful tongue? He will punish you with a warrior's sharp arrows, with burning coals of the broom tree. Woe to me that I dwell in Meshech, that I live among the tents of Kedar. Too long have I lived among those who hate peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war.
Thank you, Katrina. Now, do you remember the classic film, It's a Wonderful Life? For a lot of people, I think this is one of those real old favorites. Maybe it's fondly remembered from long ago. Maybe it's something that you actually have watched many times and it comes out every Christmas and you fall asleep halfway through on Christmas afternoon. I wonder. But above all, I'm focusing this morning, or right now anyway, on the key figure, George Bailey. I would comment that I'm one of these people who's very glad we have a governor of the Bank of England now called Bailey, and I consider him to be a kind of maybe a great nephew of George Bailey, who ran the savings and loan in the town of Bedford Falls in the film It's a Wonderful Life. I'm probably making too much of the possible link of the Bailey surname. Do you remember when George Bailey said this? I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world. And he went on to say, Italy, Greece, the Parthenon, the Colosseum. See, George Bailey is the boy who grew up dreaming of only one thing, getting out of the town where he lived, getting out of Bedford Falls, this crummy little town, he called it. And you might recall, those of you who know the film, he grew up, he saved up, he got that suitcase, he made his plans, do you remember? But somehow, he never made it. He never left that town. But I don't want to spoil the story. We've just read Psalm 120. And Psalm 120, it seems to me, was written by somebody with the same kind of mindset as George Bailey. Those words that we heard a moment ago, woe to me that I live, that I dwell in Meshech, that I live among the tents of Kedar. In other words, I am so tired of this place. I am so tired of this place. I'm going to pause for a moment and introduce you to where we are heading now and in the next few weeks. And this is it in two words, Summer Psalms. This is a distinct season, as I mentioned at the beginning of our service this morning. It's a season when there's a real holiday mood and there are people coming and going. And it does seem wise. It seems a good idea to have a change of pace, not necessarily always pressing on with the Bible's big themes, but stopping and resting beside quiet waters, if I can put it like that. Another phrase borrowed from the Psalms, of course. And so I've decided to choose a new psalm, a few psalms, between now and the end of August. The Psalms have been called the Songbook of Israel. And these would have been among the best known words of Scripture in the minds of the followers of Jesus and Jesus himself and the early church. Because these were words, the words of the Psalms were words that they would sing regularly, over and over again, repeatedly, in the way that we sing the same songs regularly. They sang the Psalms. It's well worth us getting to know them. And I've chosen to look at a very particular part of the collection in their songbook, and they're called the Psalms of Ascent, or Songs of Ascent. And that is a title, you'll see it probably in most editions, most versions of Scripture, that's a title which is attached to 15 Psalms, number 120 through to 134. And they are almost all very short. They're not uniform, they're quite varied, they touch on a number of different topics. Some of them might be unfamiliar to us, but one or two are very well known. I imagine you know the words, unless the Lord builds the house. Well, that's one of these, it's Psalm 127. And another one, how good and pleasant it is when brothers live together in unity. Maybe you know that. That's another one, Psalm 133. Now, the reason for the name, Songs of Ascent, you probably know already. They will be sung by travelers on the road to Jerusalem, probably for one of the three big festivals in the year, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. And they would speak of going up to Jerusalem. Physically, Jerusalem is on a hilltop. It's not the highest point around, but it's on a hilltop. So going up does make sense. But also, they would speak of going up to Jerusalem kind of in the same way, I think, that we speak of going up to London, because it's important as a city. And it's not up, it's at sea level, but we go up to London, and they would go up to Jerusalem. So literally and figuratively, that's the way they would speak of it. And these are songs, therefore, to sing on the way up, as you are climbing, as you are walking an uphill road. A lot of people also refer to them as the Pilgrim Psalms. That's actually a good title for us to think of, and we'll come back to that idea in a moment. This first one, Psalm 120, doesn't look like a very auspicious start. It's not that encouraging as a way to begin looking at Psalms and as a way to open up this section, the Psalms of Ascent. Verse 1, I cry out to the Lord in my distress. Verse 2, save me from all these lies and deceit. Verse 4, I'm trusting that God will deal with the liars and the deceivers. Verse 7, I just want peace when all around me there's war and aggression. And in the middle of it all, this great cry of frustration in verse 5. Woe to me that I dwell in Meshech, that I live among the tents of Kedar. Now, those are two names, of course, two names of places that probably won't mean all that much to us today. What might the psalmist say today, I wonder? Woe to me that I dwell in Bognor Regis, that I live among the caravans of Brackelsham Bay. I do apologize to anyone who is made to feel uncomfortable by my naming those names. I know I'm going to get into trouble if I do anything like that. I was going to mention Grimsby. I was going to mention Watford. I was going to mention Birmingham, but I thought John might be here, so I thought I'd better not. But I brought it close to home because, in actual fact, this is a good place to start looking at a few psalms. Because my question would be, is it about the specific place? Or is it more about what life is like? Or in fact, is it to do with what we are like? Think back to the case of George Bailey for a minute in that film, growing up in the little town of Bedford Falls that he called this crummy little town. But if he'd been growing up in another town, wouldn't he almost certainly have been saying the same? It's not that particular town, I reckon. I think it's what was in his mind. In the Psalms, in general, you can find a tone of dissatisfaction which surfaces from time to time. One of the best known examples is in Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord in a foreign land? That is a song sung by people who are displaced. In our world today, we know quite a lot about displaced people because there are so many, aren't there? Displaced around the world, refugees, prisoners of war, captives in a foreign country. People who are disconnected from their roots. They're in the wrong place and they know it. I want to tell you something that I read. This is from an American writer called Kathy McReynolds. When she discusses this psalm, Psalm 120 I'm referring to, she tells the story of a little boy called Tommy. This is the story in brief. When Tommy was born, he appeared healthy. But soon it became clear that things were not as they should be. Already as a toddler, he had problems with mobility and then with vision, and with coordination and with eating. And eventually it turned out, after much anguish and many tests, it turned out that both of Tommy's parents carried a recessive gene which meant that they passed on to him a very, very rare metabolic disorder. There was no cure. The doctors and the family found all the ways that they could to give him a decent quality of life, at least. According to his mother, he was a little boy with a very sweet spirit. He was tender and caring and interested and able to learn. But he was never fully content. And he would sometimes tell his mother that he wasn't supposed to be here. And at first, she did not understand what that meant. Tommy reached the age of 9. The disease progressed and he was losing the battle with kidney and lung problems. The doctors were still fighting in every way they could, but his mother one day saw that he was now looking peaceful, deeply peaceful. And she asked him, "Tommy, do you want to fight?" And he answered, "I'm not supposed to be here." She said, "Do you want to go home?" And he answered, "Yes." And that little boy, at the age of 9, died an hour later with a profound look of peace on his face. The writer says that Tommy's parents learned to think of him as the Lord's pilgrim. A boy, even at that young age, who somehow understood that he was only passing through, that he belonged somewhere else. What is a pilgrim? Generally, the word can mean just a wanderer, somebody who's on a journey. But when we use the word pilgrimage, we are typically thinking of a particularly long journey, and it's going towards somewhere that is thought to be very special or sacred. So historically, we might think of Canterbury or Walsingham in Suffolk or Santiago de Compostela in Spain. This morning, I'm thinking of pilgrimage as something far bigger, far more significant than those, let's call them one-off journeys. There is a lovely moment towards the end of the book of Genesis where Jacob refers to his own, his own very turbulent life as a pilgrimage. Listen to this. This is when Joseph in Egypt finally arranges for his old man and all the family to travel to Egypt. And Jacob arrives in Egypt and he's introduced to Pharaoh. I think this is funny. This is in Genesis chapter 47 because it reads as if Pharaoh takes one look at Jacob and he says, "How old are you?" Those are the words. Read them. Genesis 47 verse 9. And Jacob replies this, "The years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the years of pilgrimage of my fathers." And you see what I'm getting at here? Jacob's life, we know, we can trace, there's a lot of detail of his life over the course of about 20 chapters of the book of Genesis. His life had been full of danger and full of upsets and full of mistakes and probably, no doubt, full of regrets. And in his own estimation, he did not live up to the great illustrious example set by his father Isaac or his grandfather Abraham. But he did understand this, that his life was a pilgrimage. It was a journey towards God. And through all those ups and downs in his life, and there were ups and there were distinct downs after some of the ups, but through all of them, he was learning gradually more and more what it was to be a man of God and what it meant to worship God. I want to encourage every one of you to do something really very simple in your hearts and in your minds. Take hold of that definition. Forget Canterbury. I don't mean to disparage real places and real people who live there, but forget Canterbury. Or don't go there barefoot, okay? That's what I'm saying. Go there on a bus, go there for a day trip, have tea and scones and come back. But your pilgrimage is your whole life. And your pilgrimage is a journey towards God. Of course, we are at many different places on that journey. But that's what it is. C.S. Lewis wrote, that if we find or we detect in ourselves a desire that this world cannot satisfy, that should tell us we are meant for another world. Aren't there times, don't you think, aren't there times when you are weary of this world? And this is not just for the older ones among us. You can be young and weary as well. Most of us here are young, and as I look around, and weary. We might be weary of the lies and the deceit. We might be weary of the way people treat each other in the world around us. That never-ending impulse people have to argue and fight. There's so much that we could be weary of. The psalmist in Psalm 120 wrote of his longing for peace. I am for peace at the end of the psalm there, but when I speak, they are for war. You've probably heard many times, but the word for peace in Scripture, the Hebrew word throughout the Old Testament, and then, of course, the use of it in the New Testament by people who were speaking those languages, the word is shalom. And it is a far, far bigger word and much more profound and full of meaning kind of word than the word peace tends to suggest to us. It is way more than just the absence of conflict, just the absence of strife. It means quality of life in the deepest possible sense. It means completeness and soundness and wholesomeness and well-being. It includes physical and mental and psychological and spiritual contentment, satisfaction. Woe to me that I dwell in Meshech, that I live among the tents of Kedar. Now, I wasn't going to resort to a map today. You know, I like resorting to maps, but at the last minute, I decided to put one in because there is an interesting and slightly puzzling feature here. The only ways we can trace those places are back in the early chapters of the Bible, and Meshech is associated with a region which is distinctly to the north, about as far north as the Bible ever really talks about, probably what we would call today Caucasia. But Kedar is a tribe among the Bedouin territory in the Arabian desert to the south. So you couldn't actually live in both of those places at once, which means the way they are mentioned here in this psalm really does look like something that is consciously symbolic. They are chosen, two very different and distinct places chosen, because they represent anywhere. They represent anywhere. This is a song that is written for all people everywhere who are longing to go home. Deep within us, deep within humanity, there is a sense of spiritual incompleteness. And I think it comes to the surface probably most of all as a frustration with this world and with our own place in it. So today, introducing these few psalms, this is nothing more than an invitation. I'm not giving you any homework today, and I'm not bashing you around the head with a tambourine or with anything. This is nothing more than an invitation to take time. If you can, do you think you can? Now and over this summer, over these few weeks, make time, slow down, breathe deeply, and take stock of your life. Maybe a little bit of homework. Read through these few psalms. Doesn't take very long. 15 of them, as I said, but they, with the exception of one of them, they're all very, very short. 6, 7, 8 verses is all they reach. Have a look through them, look ahead, see where we're going. And as I said earlier at the beginning of our worship, stop and rest beside quiet waters. Let's bow our heads in prayer. Our loving God, we are aware of the